It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, Ecotopia, New Visions of Our Environmental Future. Albert Einstein famously said that we can't solve problems using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. In this hour, we'll talk with people who are trying to think differently about the environment. People are trying to get past the old scripts. For instance, maybe it's time to stop celebrating the beauty of wilderness.
That type of nature writing, or that nature writing that most people associate with the genre, is really a writing of privilege.
The politics of nature writing, and remembering Rachel Carson on the 50th anniversary of her death. But first, the environmentalist Bill McKibben was among the very first to write seriously about the danger of global warming. Now he thinks it's too late. Climate change can't be stopped. So instead, it's time to figure out how to survive in the new climate. McKibben recently laid out a new model in a book called Earth, that's Earth spelled with two A's, in which he makes the case for going small and local. Because with the cost of rising sea levels and droughts, the recent economic downturn is about to look like a walk in the park.
What's most interesting about our economic downturn is it gave us the metaphor we need to understand the whole shebang. The banks were too big to fail, okay? In Congress, that meant we must bail them out, okay? But what it really means in the real world is anything too big to fail is too big. Now, our energy system and our agricultural system are both too big to fail, and they're both showing enormous signs of stress and failure. The number of hungry people around the world is now on the upswing after going down for many years because per capita, the amount of grain we can produce has begun to fall. And our energy system, as you know, is under all kinds of stress. One of the reasons that our grain production is down is because we started diverting our corn crop into gasoline to make up for the oil that we couldn't afford anymore. It's all very connected. It's all very large. And we'd be much smarter to figure out how to build it down kind of gracefully.
Let's talk about the paradigm shift you'd like to encourage, small and local versus large and national or multinational.
I think the most important paradigm shift, almost the kind of metaphor shift, is from our current cure-all for every problem, which is growth. No matter what the problem is, the answer is grow the economy some more, you know. And it's been useful because it's avoided, we haven't had to make any hard choices because we just kept having more. But if we've run into what people 50 years ago started calling limits to growth, and melting the Arctic is a pretty good sign that you're running into some pretty profound limits, then we're going to need a different set of metaphors. What I talk about in the book is trying to figure out how to think in terms of stability and security and resilience, to try to think not of your economy as a kind of racehorse built for absolute optimum performance on an easy track, but as a kind of workhorse built for long-haul survival.
So you're talking about a much slower-growing economy. But what about the idea that we could simply invest in green power, that we could, you know, build a million or a billion windmills across the Midwest and put a solar panel on every roof and we'll spark a new economic revolution.
We're going to have to do a lot of windmills and solar panels, and I quite believe in them. But the idea that we're simply going to replace fossil fuel one for one with something else and merrily go on as we have before is, I think, delusional in a lot of ways. One, it's incredibly expensive to do that. Second, probably more fundamental, fossil fuel is different from other sources of energy. The reason that our world looks the way it does, with some highly centralized, you know, energy system, but with great sprawling suburbs and things, is because of the particular attributes of fossil fuel. It was cheap. It was easy to get at. It was rich in BTUs. It was easy to transport. It made sense to develop sort of the world that we've developed. Solar energy, the wind's energy, are different than that. They're omnipresent. They're not concentrated in one place like oil, but they're everywhere diffuse and dispersed. And so you need to start thinking about, well, the engineers would call it distributed generation. You might more easily think of it as the analogy to the internet instead of a few big broadcasting entities.
Well, I hear you suggesting really not just different technologies, but a different economic model. Every town might produce its own energy, or every state.
You're absolutely right. And that's much more, of course, how we started out with energy and things years ago. And the same with food. I mean, to become not totally self-reliant, but much more in that direction. And the right level to think at is the community, not the individual, I think. The consumer society that we've embedded ourselves in was entirely about individuals. The American economy was predicated on building bigger homes farther apart from each other. You know, that was the American dream. That's had a lot of dark sides, including the loss of connection and community. The average American has half as many close friends as the average American of 50 years ago. This conversion to a new kind of economic life, though it'll be traumatic in its transition in many ways, at least offers the hope for rebuilding some of that community. So, I mean, you here in Madison have a perfect example. You've got the greatest farmers market in the Western world, you know. The interesting thing about farmers markets is not just that the food is good and not just that it's much more ecologically sensible than bringing food 3,000 miles at a clip. The interesting thing about them is that when sociologists follow shoppers first around the supermarket and then around the farmers market, they find people at the farmers market having 10 times as many conversations per visit. That's clearly part of the attraction. It's a different world in a way.
So going local and going smaller may solve some economic problems. It may also be the antidote to some subtler psychological ills.
I don't mean to oversell the notion that it's all going to be groovy. There's going to be plenty of wrench in this transition because fossil fuel is at the absolute heart of our economic lives and has been for 200 years. But it doesn't need to be paralyzingly grim to imagine some kind of different future.
Making the case for smaller and more contained to Americans is never an easy thing. Is there a way in which, can you paint a vision of that smaller scale future that is beautiful? Does it seem beautiful and appealing to you?
There are ways that it's already happening. I mean, look at the rise of the local food movement in this country in the last 10 years. Farmers markets have been the fastest growing part of our food economy. And it's now affecting, there's enough demand that it's begun to change the agricultural landscape. The last agricultural census showed a pretty large increase in the number of farms in the U.S. That's the first time that's happened in 150 years. And it's because they're all small farms, people growing food that people want to eat, people growing food for their neighbors and making a living at it. And it's immensely more appealing than the agriculture that it's trying to replace, the, you know, swine farm with a million head of swine. That's about as unappealing a prospect as it's possible to imagine. There's a better model emerging. The question is, can we make it emerge fast enough to matter? And for that, the key question will be whether we can finally bring ourselves to put a price on fossil fuel that reflects the damage it does in the environment. That was the question at Copenhagen. It's the question in Congress. If we can do that, if we can bend the power of the fossil fuel industry enough to do that, then the economic force of gravity will work in the direction of local food, of distributed energy, of all the things we need to do, instead of forever us having to fight our way upstream to do something decent.
Bill McKibben's books about climate change include The End of Nature and Earth. He's also the co-founder of the anti-carbon group 350.org. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the death of one of the pioneers of the environmental movement, Rachel Carson. Her landmark exposé, Silent Spring, woke people up to the dangers of pesticides. But she was actually something of a reluctant activist. She preferred walking the seashore and exploring tide pools to political agitation. Rob Nixon is a scholar and environmental writer, and he holds the Rachel Carson Chair in English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He recently reread all of Rachel Carson's writing, And he told Steve Paulson he was struck by her remarkable range.
She began really as a lyricist of the ocean. She wrote a trilogy of books, Under the Sea Wind, The Sea Around Us, and The Edge of the Sea, that really established her.
And she had been a marine biologist, right?
That's right, yes. I also had encountered Carson in sequence as a teenager growing up in South Africa. I'd come across The Edge of the Sea, and I lived on the edge of the sea, 10 minutes from the Indian Ocean, and the sea was my kind of saving grace in a very conservative, rather fierce culture. And I just loved what she saw. I loved her curiosity, her wonder, and I had a childhood very much immersed in the sea. And it was not until many years later, in fact, after I immigrated to America in my 20s, that I read Silent Spring.
Which was a much more political book.
A much more political book, a much darker book. It's full of elegy, mourning, apocalypse, prophetic warnings, polemics.
And of course, this is her account of how environmental toxins like DDT were wrecking the environment.
Yes, exactly. And so one of the things that I began to think about was this question of courage and wonder, because it took a lot of courage for her to break with her voice, break with her subject. And indeed, Dorothy Freeman, who was her great friend and indeed the great love of her life, warned her at the time. She was absolutely aghast. She said, "You're going to lose your audience, you're going to get depressed, and people will never hear from you again." And an interesting remark I came across in that reading was a remark that Carson made where she said that she wasn't only doing it for society, but for her own future peace, that if she remained silent, she couldn't be at peace with herself.
So, I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, really, what you're describing is a person who loved being outdoors, especially loved being by the sea.
Yes.
And then she came to a point where she realized, you know, I have to do more than just revel in the glory of nature. I have to engage in politics because there are real threats out there that are destroying what I love.
Absolutely. And she wasn't only passionate about being by the sea, but being in the sea. She's pottering about in tide pools. And my favorite photo of her is bent over with the water halfway up her calves, just peering down into a pool. And she and her friend Dorothy, that's what they love to do, to mingle a childhood curiosity with a scientific sense of wonder as well.
Hmm. Now, I know you brought in a few passages from Rachel Carson's writing. And do you have one that would reflect
some
of this?
Yes, I do. One of the interesting things about Carson is that she grew up in rural Pennsylvania, not far from Pittsburgh, a very long way from the ocean. But early on, something in her was seeded, a passion for the ocean that led her ultimately to marine biology. So I'm just reading from an essay she wrote in 1951. "I seem to have been born with a fascination for the ocean. For years before I had ever seen it, I thought about it and dreamt about it and tried to picture what it would be like. I loved Swinburne and Masefield and all the other great poets of the sea. The stories I wrote for my classes in English composition often had a marine background. After I became interested in biology as a college student, I very naturally came to specialize in marine biology. At the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, I had my first prolonged contact with the sea. There I never tired of watching the tidal currents pouring through the hole and the waves breaking on Nobsca Point after a storm. It was there, too, that I first discovered the rich scientific literature of the sea. But it is fair to say that my first impressions of the sea were sensory and emotional, and that the intellectual response came later."
Oh, that's lovely. And it's worth pointing out that Rachel Carson was one of the great writers about wonder, the experience of wonder. In fact, she wrote a book about wonder.
She was originally going to be an English major, and so it was the poetry of the sea that got her first. But that led her to a scientific fascination. Towards the end of her life, after the success of Silent Spring, but also after she was very ill and she knew her time on Earth was limited, she started writing a book introducing children to wonder, because she realized if you can get children to observe passionately, to immerse themselves in the natural world, that is the beginning of all sorts of things, leading, among other things, very often to scientific careers.
Now, there's a tragic element to Rachel Carson's life as well. She became very sick, and I don't know if it was while she was writing Silent Spring. And I mean, there's sort of a terrible, I don't know if irony is the right word. I mean, she's writing about environmental toxins, and she develops breast cancer at that very moment.
Yes. So she battled. She really battled with writing through that, and she had rheumatism and various other afflictions, heart disease, and it was a struggle, particularly towards the end.
What was the reaction when Silent Spring was published in, 1962?
It was immense. Partly for the book itself, but there was also a PBS documentary that came out shortly that was, I think, watched simultaneously by 1 in 10 Americans, which is absolutely huge. President Kennedy acknowledged it. There's no question that it contributed a great deal to the forming of the EPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act.
Wasn't she also attacked by the big chemical companies? I mean, DuPont, Dow, Monsanto.
Right. DuPont, Dow, Monsanto, Velsicol. And this was a time when I think 1% of tenured scientists in America were women. So she was very, very vulnerable on that front. One review that I recall by a professor at Vanderbilt, in the medical school at Vanderbilt, the title of the review was "Silent, Miss Carson."
Keep quiet. Yeah, shut up.
Absolutely. And a former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture said, "How can a spinster possibly be interested in genetics? She's probably a communist." So the fact that she was a woman, the fact that she was not married, the fact that she did not have children were all wielded against her.
Recently, you went to South Africa to participate in a symposium, give a series of talks on Rachel Carson, 50 years after Silent Spring was published. Does she have much of a following in South Africa?
You know, one of the interesting things about Carson is that Silent Spring in particular has resonated in so many different contexts, in so many different worlds. Even though the science has moved on since the 60s, there are certain issues that she raised that resonate, like the question of environmental justice, unequal exposure to risk, unequal access to resources. Those are very contemporary issues.
The fact that the poor tend to be much more exposed to these environmental problems than the rich.
Absolutely. Another aspect to this journey I took through Carson's writings was that I just finished writing a book called Slow Violence and the Environmentalism of the Poor. And it had largely been inspired by Carson. I was writing about writer activists engaged in environmental struggles in the global south, places like Nigeria, India, the Middle East. And I could sense the resonance that her work had had in these different corners of the world. And also came to appreciate more something that she wrote at one point, where she talked about the secret tension between love and despair. These activists in the global south were fighting extraordinary odds, and I was constantly searching for hope. And there were stories of hope, sometimes stories of martyrdom, people killed for their commitments.
Now, Rachel Carson died in April of 1964 at the age of 55. She was quite young when she died. I know you brought in another piece of writing by her, which was actually read at her memorial service. Could you read that?
Sure. And this is a letter that she wrote to Dorothy Freeman. It was one of the last things she wrote, and she was reminiscing about a wonderful September day they spent at the beach. I think it really captures her spirit and her sense of wonder. "Most of all, I shall remember the monarch butterflies, that unhurried westward drift of one small winged form after another, each drawn by some invisible force. We talked a little about their migration, their life history. Did they return? We thought not, for most, at least, this was the closing journey of their lives. But it occurred to me this afternoon, remembering that it had been a happy spectacle, that we had felt no sadness when we spoke of the fact that there would be no return. And rightly, for when any living thing has come to the end of its life cycle, we accept that end as natural. For the monarch butterfly, that cycle is measured in a known span of months. For ourselves, The measure is something else. When that intangible cycle has run its course, it is a natural and not unhappy thing that a life comes to its end. That is what those brightly fluttering bits of life taught me this morning. I found a deep happiness in it, so I hope may you. Thank you for this morning.
That was a letter by Rachel Carson, read at her memorial service 50 years ago. Rob Nixon is the Rachel Carson Professor of English at the University of Wisconsin. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, Ecotopia and the politics of nature writing. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and we're talking about Ecotopia in this hour. We can't do a show called Ecotopia without talking about the visionary novel of that title by a guy named Ernst Kallenbach. Our producer, Charles Monroe Kane, once tried living out some of those ideas, at least for a few weeks. Charles, start by reminding us, what was this book?
Well, it's an amazing science fiction book, Ecotopia, which what it sounds like. It's an ecological utopia written in 1974. It's like a guidebook. It's like setting up the principles of how to live in harmony with nature. And part of living in harmony with nature is living in harmony with each other, because war is certainly bad for the environment. And so it's kind of like a blueprint of how to live in this perfect world that's set in the future by people who are already living it.
So it's a big world vision.
It's a world vision. And I worked for this organization in Europe back in 1991 when I was a young 22-year-old. And the founder of the organization was so inspired by the book when it first came out, he created Ecotopia. And he would do it in a different country every year, different European country every year. And young people, mostly college students, would get together and try to live the ideals of the book.
What do you mean he created Ecotopia?
He would pick a country, he'd find a spot, and he would say, okay, everybody meet me June 1st for 6 weeks, and everyone read the book before you come. And let's try to live the ideals that are inside the book.
And you did this?
Absolutely. Not only did I just do it, I did it for a living. I was the organizer of Ecotopia for Bulgaria in 1992. I was living in Amsterdam, and that's what I did.
So you guys, all of you young people, created this giant, I picture some giant camp in the mud with everybody hoping that they're going to save the world.
Yes. You're completely correct. Keep guessing. Maybe we'll get the whole thing right. I don't have to talk at all. Yeah. 1,000 or more people show up in Bulgaria.
So what did you do?
There are a couple of things. I had to have a foundation for everyone. You had to have a place to go to the bathroom so we wouldn't get cholera. It was reasonable, right? You had to have clean drinking water, and we had to feed people. That's it. That's what we offered. So we had to have solar panels to clean water. We had to have, you know, vegan food for everyone, 3 meals a day for 1,000 people is no small feat. And then, you know, like I said, you had to have porta potties. We used the methane gas from the porta potties to fuel the food cooking, you know, because you can do
this
that.
This does not sound like a good idea.
No, you're gonna, you don't smell
it. The gas from the porta potties fuels your food?
Yeah, it's very ecological. It's in the book, actually. After that was done, there were no other rules. We considered it a workshop camp.
So it's a giant teach-in.
Oh, it's a giant teach-in. And there'd be little signs on trees and
what
come here.
What were people teaching?
Oh, everything. There was a guy that taught a class on multiple relationships and how to handle multiple relationships. There was a great – one of my favorite ones, actually, my friend Ace from Curacao. This was back in the day. I'm old, right? This is Walkman time, right? And you get your cigarette pack and you take out your cellophane from the cigarette pack and you get the tinfoil part, that and a paperclip, and you'd hook it to your Walkman so you could have a solar-powered Walkman. Because we had a no-battery rule, you couldn't have any battery. We couldn't use any electricity, including batteries, so you could solar-power it. It was amazing that you could do it that fast. And it,
tell
anything.
Me the truth. The real, it was just a giant party, wasn't it?
It in some ways, there was a certain hippie lifestyle that happened there. There was a lot of nudity. It was messy and it was complicated. But it was these meetings we had constantly throughout the day that kind of taught me a lot about direct democracy and the idea of process. Because you know what happens is, like, you want to save polar bears. It's okay, I can live with that. I want to save polar bears. But why are polar bears losing their habitat? Okay, you get involved in capitalism. So that's easy. Okay, so now I'm against capitalism. But then you're like, well, that kind of gets involved. Why is there capitalism? That kind of gets involved in patriarchy. Well, I don't like patriarchy. So, okay, I'm going to get rid of patriarchy. And you keep layering this onion back and layering this onion back till you get to the core. And the core was direct democracy. And seeing direct democracy in action in an anarchist way at this camp for 6 weeks, where people got together every single day for hours a day to figure out problems, was amazing. It didn't work. It didn't go well. There were fights. It was a nightmare. When you get into arguments about whether or not honey is vegan or not, and if we should be serving it or not for 4 hours, you do want to go crazy. But now I look back at it, and I'm like, are you kidding me? It was beautiful.
So, Charles, that was then. This is 20 years later. You're not a stoned peace activist living in a tent anymore.
No,
you're
not.
You're a married father of two. You've got a house, a car, a mortgage, a nice job in public radio.
Yeah, I'm your producer.
How do you look back on that experience?
Well, if you look back on it and say, did we live this novel's ideals? Absolutely not. Of course not. And so you could see it, and I think I did initially, you could see it as a failure. But dealing with direct democracy, dealing with those with less power than you, it was very powerful. And I take away from it the fact that there were a lot of people in a dirty field who slept with each other, who fought with each other, who cried together, who sat around campfires. Those people tried to make it happen. Most people don't even try. And I respect the attempt because I now understand that the process is just as important as the end product. You know, to quote The Alchemist, right, that turning base metal into gold, that salvation is in the journey. It is.
But do you think it did actually have any real world impact?
It's hard to say. I've stayed in contact. I'm Facebook friends with another number of people from Ecotopia from that long ago. They're not like buskers in the streets with like dirty fingers from smoking too many cigarettes and they're heroin addicts. That's not what happened to people who went to these camps. They went on to get their PhDs. They went on to be – three people I know for sure went on to be parliament members, Green Party members, one in Bulgaria and two in the Czech Republic. Leaders, one guy's now president of Friends of the Earth. You know, if I wrote a book in 1974 and someone this many years later would say that about my book, I would be very proud of it if I was him. And no, we don't live in an ecologically perfect world, but there are people out there striving, and I think that I would be proud to be a part of that process if I was him. I'm proud to be part of that process.
It also gave you a whole lot of really great stories to tell.
Yeah, I can't tell most of them on public radio, but I am proud of most of the stories.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Charles Monroe Kane is not only a former Ecotopian, he's also our producer. And just as he discovered that there's a certain amount of tedium and squalor involved in trying to change the world, there's a new movement challenging nature writers to get a little grittier. Because right now, when you think about nature writing, you think of beautiful essays celebrating unspoiled wilderness. But you don't pick up a nature magazine and expect to see photos of toxic waste sites or depressed neighborhoods. And maybe you should. Laurette Savoy is a geologist at Mount Holyoke College, and she's the co-editor of a book called The Colors of Nature. She'd like to see nature writers be more upfront about issues of race and poverty, and this is personal for her. She told Jim Fleming that as an African American, she is really tired of being asked why there's so little nature writing by people of color.
I say, of course there is. There's a lot. I'm often asked the twin question, why don't African Americans care about the environment? And my answers to both questions are, well, one, yes, we do, and there's a lot of writing. Part of the problem, I think, is the frame within which nature and environmental writing is published. The frame is limited to the extent that it excludes culturally and ethnically rich and diverse voices.
So really what we need to do, you're saying, is redefine what is nature writing, not who's writing it.
Exactly. Redefine nature writing, beginning by redefining or rethinking what environment is and what nature is. I imagine environment very broadly, not just as air or land or water that we depend on or that we pollute, but as the circumstances, conditions, and contexts in which we all live our lives. So that definition falls short if you don't include the experiences of place that are exiled or degraded, migrant or urban, toxic or dispossessed.
I understand what you're saying, but I think we have to start by recognizing what I suspect both of us know is generally referred to as nature writing. It's somebody out writing about the glory of wildflowers in the Rocky Mountains. It is writing about going for a stroll through the stony New England countryside.
Right.
And that is nature writing.
That is nature writing. And there's more. That type of nature writing, or that nature writing that most people associate with the genre, is really a writing of privilege. And there is so much writing about our place in the world or an individual's place in the world that's based on the lack of choice or based on poverty. And those stories are as important as moving into the wilderness, as exploring the natural world. But there are also elements of reclaiming one's heritage, of finding home or recognizing that home can be an urban garden that's carved out of a brownfield, but it is a place that you can claim.
So writing about that urban garden is just as much nature writing as writing about alpine fields.
I think so. Because where do we live primarily? Are we living in the alpine fields, or are we living more in urban communities? We don't need to go elsewhere to find nature. We can find it right here under our feet.
That, of course, is true for everybody. For specifically the subject at hand, writers of color writing about nature, there are other issues. The one that you start with is New Orleans. New Orleans, especially post-Katrina, but you can't talk about New Orleans post-Katrina without talking about New Orleans as a whole, can you?
No, you can't. And I think you can understand the true impact of the breaching of the levees following the hurricane if you understand the historical context. After the Civil War, African Americans who had been enslaved and then were trying to gain access to find a home, they were only able to get the lowest line, least desirable places there, the areas that were flood prone, that were mosquito bound. And that segregation continued all the way through the 20th century. And if you think about poverty and the ability to leave, to evacuate, so few people of color who were below the poverty line had cars, and mass transportation failed them. And so they were truly burdened by the historical legacy of racism, and on top of that, the disaster of the levees breaching.
Isn't the writing about this issue political writing, sociological writing? Although I'm beginning to see that any writing about place is what you're saying is nature writing.
Any writing about place and one's relationship to place is a form of nature writing. The case in point of writing about wilderness areas as if wilderness areas are completely pristine or untouched really is largely an illusion. Because at the time that the national parks were first established at the end of the 19th century, and at the time that the idea of wilderness with John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, the first great battle for wilderness with Hetch Hetchy, at that time, land was being set aside as pristine at the same time that Native peoples were being removed from that very land and set aside in reservations. And I very much think that wilderness areas need to be saved, but we also need to recognize their origin. They were not completely unpeopled or unpopulated land.
Of course, many people will be familiar with the names of John Muir and Gifford Pinchot. Are there other names that we should know, people who write about those issues?
Well, let's turn our eyes back, if we can, to prior to the Civil War. African-American abolitionists were fighting against slavery, and at the same time, many of them were fighting and writing against the use of arsenic in tobacco fields. Over a century ago, two wonderful writers, Sarah Winnemucca, who is of Paiute heritage, and Zitkala Saa, a Lakota Dakota woman, noted the parallels between the racism that their people were experiencing at the hand of European or Euro-American settlers and the degradation of the land due to the environmental attitudes of those same settlers. The close parallel, the degradation of a people and the degradation of a land.
We have talked a little bit about the problem that Katrina caused in New Orleans. It's by no means alone.
Right.
We have people living in areas near hazardous waste because they couldn't afford to live further away from it.
And because the people who did live farther away from it and had the money and power to keep the waste sites or cement plants or you can name quite a few different polluting industries who had the power to put them elsewhere. You could think of Camden, New Jersey as a case in point. There's a neighborhood in Camden, New Jersey that does have a cement plant on one side of a playground and a waste disposal, an incinerator on the other side. And the asthma rates of the children who live in that neighborhood have skyrocketed, as has the incidence of cancer.
Again, what you're really saying is that you can't even really think about nature without thinking about the politics and the sociology of it, but the cultural divide. When did this notion begin to change for you?
My work really has always been at the edges or the boundaries. In my education, from art to science, and then as a woman who is African-American, but also within African-American, also Native American, Euro-American, but not having access to those others because I'm labeled in one box. Check, she's black. When I was a little girl, I would say 4 or 5 years old, I had the self theory. We lived in California at that time, which is where I was born. And that is that sky flows in my veins and that sun colored my skin because I looked like sun in afternoon light, just like the California land. And that's what I believed colored meant. But then we moved to Washington, D.C., around the time of the 1968 riots. And I'm 7, turning 8, and I learned that colored has another meaning. And I learned when someone spat on me, tore my dress, pushed me into the mud, and called me nigger. And I realized that race almost trumped what I thought I was. I thought I was born within Earth. And I think growing up and coming to where I am now, it's been maybe an attempt to acknowledge how these two fragments, and they became fragments in 1968, actually belong together.
Laurette Savoy teaches environmental studies and geology at Mount Holyoke College, and she's the co-editor of the book The Colors of Nature. You'll find links to some of the essays in the book on our website at ttbook.org. And that wraps up the conversation about environmental thinking. But coming up, what's on our minds this week is Michael Lewis and his new book on Wall Street's Byzantine world of high-frequency trading. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Time for a dangerous idea.
I'm Max Tegmark, physics professor at MIT, and my dangerous idea is that we are much more significant than we once thought. I used to get more and more depressed when I studied cosmology, my day job, to realize that reality was so much vaster than we thought, feeling more and more insignificant. But now, I've totally changed my mind. First of all, even though we have enormous numbers of stars and galaxies out there, we have very little clue how likely it is to get life on any one of them. It's perfectly possible that in the part of space that we have any contact with at all, that we call our universe, we might actually be the only life advanced enough to build telescopes. We don't know that, but suppose it's true. That means that the galaxies out there that I thought were so beautiful are only beautiful because we're looking at them. They only became beautiful 400 years ago when we first pointed telescopes at the sky. And rather than looking at our universe to give meaning to us, it's we who give meaning to our universe. If we somehow wiped out on this planet, then all that awesome stuff out there in space would just be a giant waste of space, as far as I'm concerned, not making us feel insignificant at all. Another reason I felt insignificant was because I knew that even if I eat my vitamins and I work out, you know, and live 100 years, that's not much compared to the 13.8 billion years of our universe. But I feel that the particular time that we're living in right now is maybe the most important and significant time ever in our cosmos, because we've reached this fork in the road where our cosmos has become self-aware. We have the technology now for the first time to move off our planet and help life ultimately spread into space, maybe making much of our universe come alive. And we also have the technologies for the first time to actually snuff it out and end life here. And if in the distant future our whole cosmos has come alive, I have no idea how our distant descendants are going to think of us. But I'm sure that they're not going to think about us as insignificant, because their whole existence will depend on what we did on this little spinning ball in space here in our lifetime. I used to think that there must be all those aliens out there just because there's so many stars that it seemed kind of inevitable. But I've changed my mind about that, because actually there are not infinitely many, and there's only 10 to the power 78 atoms even in the whole universe that we can see. And we have almost no clue how likely it is to get life evolving to the point of building telescopes on any given planet. I think we have to be very humble and not assume that there are going to be all these aliens bailing us out if we screw up. I think we should assume that we should be cautious and really be good stewards of our planet, make the best of this opportunity we have, and act as if it's up to us.
Max Tegmark is a theoretical physicist at MIT and author of Our Mathematical Universe. You'll find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now, On Our Minds. This week we're thinking about the stock market and Michael Lewis's new bestseller, Flash Boys. Now, if you've read any of his previous books, from Liar's Poker to The Big Short, you know Michael Lewis is something rare, a writer who can make the arcane world of high finance entertaining. He's done it again with Flash Boys, a riveting account of how high-frequency trading may be corrupting Wall Street. Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Michael, when did you first realize there might be some big ethical problems with high-frequency trading?
The fall of 2012, I was digging around in a story about a high-frequency trading programmer who Goldman Sachs had managed to help get put in jail after he left Goldman Sachs and took some code with him. And because I was doing that story, I had to learn what high-frequency trading was.
But the thing that I found astonishing reading your book is apparently there were lots of major players on Wall Street that didn't know much about high-frequency trading either.
So this is the point that I found kind of so amazing, that the main character of my book is a 30-something-year-old Canadian guy who realizes something is amiss about 2008. The market starts to behave differently than it's behaved before. And he goes on this kind of personal quest to figure out what on earth is going on in this market. How is it structured? When he comes out of this a year later, he has a description of the market that is news to basically all the big investors in America. I mean, the people who run mutual funds and pension funds and hedge funds. I mean, it's not that these people are ignorant. They're aware that there are problems in the market. They're aware that, like, every time they go to buy and sell, all of a sudden it's as if someone is in front of them and knows what they're doing. They're troubled but they don't have an explanation. They don't know. And the reason they don't know is that the brokers don't tell them.
You'll have to explain what high-frequency trading is. I mean, how does this work?
So high-frequency trading, very broadly, is using computer algorithms to make very, very, very high-speed trades, lots of trades in a very short time, removing the human being from it entirely, except the human being, of course, programs the computer. But high-frequency trading can be everything from actually identifying interesting relationships between securities and betting on those relationships to front-running investors' orders. I mean, so it's not one thing.
When you say front-running investors' orders, how does that work?
Say I want to buy 500 shares of Microsoft at $20 a share. A front-runner finds out I want to do this, goes onto the exchanges and buys the Microsoft at $20 a share and sells it back to me at a higher price.
And this is all
it's scalping. It's like ticket scalping.
And this is all because these computers are set up to somehow detect your order to buy a fraction of a second faster than you can actually make that purchase.
The high-frequency traders are also given privileged access to the stock exchanges and the data from the stock exchanges, so they actually know prices before the official market knows them. They know today's prices, and you and I know yesterday's prices, and we're trading on yesterday's prices.
Now, the thing that's so amazing about the story is how time, milliseconds, matter here. I mean, we're talking a thousandth of a second. That actually is extremely valuable.
It's very hard for the human mind to imagine a millisecond. A millisecond is a thousandth of a second. It takes 100 of them to blink your eye if you're really good at blinking your eye. The stock market, to the naked eye, looks instantaneous. If you go on your computer and trade through your electronic broker, you say, I want to buy some stock or sell some stock. It looks like it happens instantaneously.
Right.
And what you don't realize is that from the point of view of the computer, that isn't instantaneous. It's actually rather slow. And that the computer can have made 1,000 moves in a blink of an eye.
How does the computer do this? I mean, how do these high-frequency traders get this information faster than we can sitting at our own computers?
They get the faster information by paying the stock exchanges to locate their boxes, their computers, right next to the stock exchange box. They pay for what's called direct feeds of what's going on in the 13 public stock exchanges in the United States into their own box and are able to assemble a picture before the official market gets the picture.
So what percentage of trading on the stock market is made up by high-frequency trading?
A bit more than half.
Half. So let's come back to your story, the people that you write about, this young guy, Brad Katsuyama, who's working with the Royal Bank of Canada, and he starts to realize that something is wrong here. What does he do?
Well, you have to kind of understand what his job is to appreciate the predicament he finds himself in. He is the head of stock market trading at this bank. So you're a big mutual fund. You need to sell 1 million shares of Microsoft, and you can't just unload it in the marketplace. So what Brad Katsuyama would do is buy it all in a private deal, and he would take over a period of the day or 2 days, sell it off into the marketplace in a gentle way. His desk has screens on it, and on these screens are the markets for all stocks in the 13 public stock exchanges. And up until 2008, the market on his screens was accurate. So if the market said that there were 50,000 shares of Microsoft offered in the public markets at $20 a share, if he hit the button on his computer, he would just buy 50,000 shares of Microsoft at $20 a share instantly. In 2008, he hits the button, and all of a sudden, the market's not the market. All of a sudden, when he goes to buy Microsoft, the price has gone up. So the market's behaving as if it knows what he wants to do before he does it. He doesn't understand why. So what does he do? He takes his fist and hits the side of his computer. He does what you and I do when our computer screen freezes. He thinks it's the box on his desk right. That's the problem. He then calls tech support. He's a trader. He says, my computer doesn't work. And they say, they don't really know. So the story of this book is him figuring out what on earth just happened. How does the stock market work now?
Now, the thing that's so inspiring about the story of Brad, this young guy who figured this out, is once he finds out what's going on, that he's getting screwed and lots of other people are as well, he doesn't try to join the system to make big bucks, which obviously he could have. He wants to try to fix it. He thinks this is wrong.
What do you do when you know something other people don't and you can use it to your advantage to make a lot of money, or you can use it to make the world a fairer place? And he doesn't even think about it. It's just the natural, his natural reaction is just go tell people, try to fix the system.
And his attempt is to try to get rid of this millisecond time lag between what the high-frequency traders have access to and what the ordinary investors do.
Yes. They design a way, a button on his terminal that delays the buy signal to the first exchange so that the buy order arrives at all 13 exchanges at precisely the same time within a couple of microsecond window. And this solves the problem. It's his first bid to fix the problem. The big bid is he leaves his job at the Royal Bank of Canada, which pays him millions of dollars a year. He leaves this very secure, high-paying trading Wall Street job to start a business. And the business is a fair exchange, a fair stock exchange. And this is the radical act, because in doing this, he sort of presents the entire financial system with a choice. So he creates a storm, a war. And that's what he's in the middle of now. I mean, this is happening now. A war between investors whose money is being handled, whose stock market orders are being handled, and the Wall Street firms who are handling them with various degrees of inefficiency.
The charge that you have made, a very serious charge, which has caused all kinds of controversy. I mean, you say the markets are rigged.
You know, it's funny that that word resonates the way it does. I mean, I can't think of a better word to describe this systematic scalping. What is it when a very small group of people are given inside access of all price movements to which the rest of the investment public is oblivious? It's like every time you go to a horse race, having to bet against someone who knows the result of the race before it's run.
I want to expand this discussion a little bit to step away from high-frequency trading specifically and talk a little bit more about Wall Street in general, because there is this popular perception that Wall Street is fundamentally exploitative, if not actually corrupt. I mean, we all know that the gap between rich and poor keeps growing, and our economic and political system seems to be set up to help Wall Street get richer. Do you see it that way?
It's complicated. So this is how I see it. I think that Wall Street has lost the trust of the rest of society. The problem, though, it's not that Wall Street just attracts every villain on earth and these are just naturally villainous people, because it's not that at all. They're really great people that work on Wall Street. It's the incentive system. The system of incentives is really screwed up. It's really screwed up, for example, for Wall Street firms to make huge sums of money and people to take home huge bonuses, making lots of subprime loans that will never be repaid. It's really screwed up for brokers to get paid lots of money to mishandle stock market orders, and for exchanges to be paid lots of money to sell out most investors to high-frequency traders. I mean, I think that the problem is it's a problem of incentives.
That's Michael Lewis talking with Steve Paulson. Lewis is the author of the number one bestseller, Flash Boys. And that's it for today. But it's always nice to know what you think. Why not chat with us on Facebook? We post new things there all the time. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, Stephanie Youngblood, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.